بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على نبينا محمد وأشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له وأشهد أن محمدا عبده ورسوله. أما بعد, so inshallah tonight's lecture, as I assume you all heard, is going to be about the concept of Islamophobia moving from the fringe to the mainstream. And inshallah, you're all familiar with the concept of Islamophobia. I guess you can describe it as irrational fear and hatred of Islam. I'm not going to worry too much about the definition and go into that. But I'm going to speak more about some aspects of history and some aspects of the recent developments with respect to Islamophobia. You know, the history of Islam in America and the history of the relationship between the United States and Islam goes pretty far back. Obviously, the people who settled the United States, the colonialists, they were coming from Europe. Europe had a long history with conflict with Islam. So there's already that history behind it, but at the same time, when they eventually started to create the United States, one of the first issues that came up at that time that was discussed by people like Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and John Locke and so forth, one of the questions that they discussed is whether or not it is permissible for a Muslim to be president of the United States. So that was one of the questions that was discussed from the earliest days of the United States. And of course, when Barack Obama was the supposed, and of course this is related to Islamophobia and so forth, because the people who were spreading the rumors that Barack Obama is a Muslim are basically the various Islamophobic organizations. But so then the same question came up as to, you know, can we actually have a Muslim be a president? So that's a debate, and that's a debate that split the founding fathers of the United States as to whether or not it's acceptable for a Muslim to be, for a Muslim to be a president of the United States. Of course, the debate went much further than that, and that is even whether or not it's allowed for certain kinds of Christians or Catholics or Jews to be president of the United States. Some of you might be familiar with the fact that that we didn't have a Catholic president until 1960. All those years, they were all Protestants. But as I said, specifically also they brought up the question about Muslims. Is it okay? Are Muslims going to be, in other words, considered part of the civil society in the United States? And the history and the interrelationship between the United States and Islam goes even much further than that. You're probably familiar with the fact that Morocco was the first country that recognized the independence of the United States. At the same time, the writing of the Constitution, one of the main reasons behind the writing of the Constitution, why they got together to write the Constitution, was actually because they were facing the fact that they were going to have to go to war against the Muslim countries of North Africa, Algeria, Tunis. They were known by these names as Tunis, Morocco, Algeria, and so forth. Basically, they understood that they're going to go to war against these people, but they had nothing by this time. They had nothing they had no way to raise taxes. They had no right to create a navy. So they had to do all of these things, and this is what eventually led to the drafting of the Constitution and so forth of the United States. And by 1800, they had declared war on Algeria after some other, actually Tripoli was the one that declared war on the United States first. After other, many things didn't quite work out. In addition to that, in American society, there's a very strong there's a very strong Zionist movement within American Christianity that actually dates back to the 1600s, even long before, again, the creation of the United States as a country. The idea of bringing the Jews back to Israel and so forth, and this is a key to Armageddon and the return of Jesus and all of this. This is an idea and this is a concept that has been well established and it's been existing within the Christian organizations long before the history of, or the creation of Israel. In fact, the Zionist movement really started among these Christians much more than it ever was started among the Jews. So you have all of these things going on, and then also the Americans were very fascinated with the book 1001 Arabian Nights. You know, they thought that was a true presentation of the Arab world. So they also had these kind of fantasy issues of what the Arab world was all about. Given all of these interactions that the United States had with Muslims and so forth, we know that by the time that by the time that September 11th came along, September 11th, of course, was a moment that you can say shook the United States. But even though they had all of this long history at some level of interaction with Islam, and of course the slavery, the slave trade, and so forth, that's another issue, a separate category in itself. But when polls were done after 9/11 to see how well Americans knew Islam, only one third of Americans could correctly identify what is the Quran and who is Allah. So only one third. And about two thirds of them responded that they had never met a Muslim in person. So this is 9/11, around the time of 9/11. And by this time, though, there had been different Muslim organizations who had been working actively in the United States to kind of establish Islam as part of civil society here in the United States. So we all know, for example, about ISNA and CARE, and there's other organizations that were there as well. And these organizations, you can say they gave the Muslim community in the United States a political identity. There were things done, for example, a Muslim led the prayer and the opening prayer in the Congress. There was a Muslim chaplain appointed for the military. So the Muslims were established in many different ways, even politically speaking, by 9/11. In fact, on 9/11, on the day of 9/11 itself, let me go back a little bit before that. Before 9/11, before the elections, before 9/11, there were many Muslim organizations and many Arab organizations in particular that were unhappy with the Clinton administration. Even though they had some good interaction with the Clinton administration, but in particular, they were unhappy with the idea of secret evidence, which the Clinton administration established and kept and supported. So during the elections of 2000, the Muslims met with Bush and his people, and they agreed that they would overturn the Clinton era law on secret evidence. And this was one of the main reasons why many of these organizations supported President Bush in the 2000 elections. Now, in politics, it takes time to do things. So President Bush did not overturn this immediately. But over time, Karl Rove, who was like Bush's right-hand man, or maybe Bush was Rove's right-hand man, depending on how you look at it. But anyway, over time, Karl Rove eventually told the Arab and Muslim groups that the law is going to be overturned. So people like Samuel Arian, which I'm sure many of you have heard of, who was just recently deported from the United States, finally, after house arrest for many years. Samuel Arian and a number of Muslim and Arab leaders were in Washington, D.C. on September 11th 2001, because on that day Bush was going to announce and have a public have a press conference with the leaders of the Muslim and Arab organizations. He was going to announce that he's overturning the secret evidence law, as he had promised in his campaign to these Muslim groups. Of course, September 11th happened. That was canceled. And as you know, the airports were all closed. And a few days later, you know, Bush came out. Bush, you know, with all of his critique that we can have of Bush, Bush and other organizations at that time were actively trying to separate what happened on 9/11 from Islam as a whole. So not a few days after 9/11, he actually was seen publicly with all of these Arab groups and trying to say that, you know, we have to separate Islam from what these terrorists did. And so people were asking, how did those Muslims get, you know, because the airports were closed. The airport in Washington, D.C. was closed. How did these Arabs get to Washington, D.C. to meet with the president just a few days after 9/11? And, of course, then you get the conspiracy that, oh, there's something going on and the Arabs are all part of it. No, they were there actually before 9/11. And they were stuck there because of 9/11. And that's why they were there and part of the meeting with President Bush. But the significance also of that meeting with President Bush is that when some polls were taken after a few months after 9/11, a couple months after 9/11, when you compare the public opinion polls toward Muslim Americans before 9/11 and after 9/11, immediately after 9/11, the percentage of people who had a favorable opinion of Muslim Americans actually increased in November 2001 from previous before 9/11. Okay. So 9/11 occurred, right? You had this big disaster essentially that everyone in the news is saying, you know, it's done by Muslims and so forth. And given all of that that took place, the polls showed that the Americans had a more favorable view, or at least they responded, I should say. They responded that they had a more favorable view, or more people responded saying they had a favorable view of American Muslims after 9/11, shortly after 9/11, than even before 9/11. Now, if you go from where we are right now to back to 9/11, you see that things have changed a lot. Now, a few years ago, I think it was 2010 was when these studies came out. In 2010, this was the first time, if you put together different polls, in 2010 and 2011, this is the first time in which in these polls, more people have, in the United States, more people have an unfavorable view of Islam than a favorable view. Okay. So before it was, even after 9/11, even for years after 9/11, it was still people had a more favorable view of Islam than an unfavorable view. Starting around 2010, 2011, this started to change. It started to go over 50%. But the thing is that it continued to increase to be unfavorable towards Islam and Muslims, to the point now that some recent polls say that Americans as a whole consider Islam the least respectable of all the religions. Obviously, many things took place between 9/11 and now, okay? And Muslims continue to give lots of ammunition for the Islamophobes. There's been a number of terrorist attacks that have taken place, a number of things that have happened since 9/11. However, even given that fact, there have been some studies done, some pretty well-documented studies that have been done, that have shown the rise of certain anti-Islam groups, certain Islamophobic groups, that at the time of 9/11, These were very insignificant groups. Almost no one paid any attention to them. And now they are very powerful groups. They are politically very powerful groups, and they're also very rich, very well-funded groups now. So these groups have become very powerful, and they have moved from, and that's the name of the lecture, they have moved from being fringe groups. And fringe groups means they are kind of, on the outside looking in. People don't take them that seriously. They're not representing the views of the majority. And they don't maybe have that much influence in government and so forth. They have gone from being fringe groups to being what you can call mainstream groups, where now their point of view is not considered strange or abnormal or like an outlier. But actually now their point of view is becoming more and more accepted, spoken at different levels, and represented even at the highest levels of government, unfortunately. So what happened between, for example, 9/11 and now? As I said, many people have studied this phenomenon. First of all, of course, 9/11, you have to realize that 9/11 itself is something that you could describe it as something that disrupts the status quo, in the sense that, other than Pearl Harbor, other than when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor in World War II, the beginning of the American involvement in World War II, it's been very rare that there's been any attack on American soil. You have to go back to one of the early wars in the 1800s to find attacks on American soil. And also at the same time, many Americans feel like America is the leader of the world. People are looking up to us and respecting us. And so their worldview was very much shattered on 9/11. And now comes the question of, how can you explain 9/11? How are you going to answer 9/11 for these people who had a certain view of the world, and now something that is the complete opposite of their worldview has taken place? Many of the, as I was alluding to earlier, with respect to Bush and so forth, right after 9/11, many what you call civil society organizations, the World Council of Churches and even the Anti-Defamation League and all sorts of groups came out in support of Muslims and Islam to try to say, look, don't identify what happened with 9/11, what happened in 9/11 with Islam and Muslims. And that's why shortly after 9/11, as I said, you actually had an increase in the favorable response to Islam. But slowly but surely, in the media, so as I said, 9/11 requires a response. And these people who, as I said, were virtually unknown, some of them, I mean, they were known, but they weren't that well respected. For example, one of them, his name is Stephen Emerson. He projects himself as an expert on terrorism. After the Oklahoma City bombing, he came out publicly and he said, this has the Middle East all over it. We know that this was done by Muslims and so forth. So he lost credibility on a number of occasions. But 9/11 was the opening for these people. They built their approach after 9/11 on emotion and mostly fear and anger. And of course you have to realize that media is demand driven. Media nowadays is very sensationalistic. If you come on, for example, after 9/11, and unfortunately, and some Muslim, a lot of Muslim organizations did this, like CARE, for example, and others. After 9/11, you had a couple of choices that you could do out in the public, especially as these groups started to get more and more vocal. As these people get more and more vocal, they are really attacking Islam. Even if they say, we know that there's mostly peaceful Muslims, in reality they are attacking Islam. So Muslims will take it as an attack on Islam. So they'll try to explain. They'll try to explain 9/11, for example, by saying, you know, there's a lot of factors that drive people to terrorism. There's a lot of factors that drive people to extremism and so forth. This kind of response is not what the American people at that time, and not even what the media at that time, was really interested in. So this, as I said, this opened the door for a few groups, a few organizations, to really take advantage of this vacuum of the explanation of what is going on. And I'm going to give you right now, I guess, the names of the basic individuals and the basic organizations involved. Some people say there's basically five key people and five organizations. There's much more than that, but these are the ones who are behind it, especially from 9/11. And these are the ones who took advantage of the situation at 9/11. So these are names that you should know. First of all, you should know them already. And the reason I say you should know them already is because, recently I was giving also a lecture on Islamophobia, and I started talking about Stephen Emerson and Robert Spencer and Frank Gaffney, and I asked the audience, like you people, oh, I'm going to ask you people, okay, how many of you are familiar with Stephen Emerson, Frank Gaffney, and Daniel Pipes and so forth? Okay. How many of you are familiar? Okay, so okay. On the men's side, there's more. At least, okay. The reason why I say it is important that Muslims should be familiar with them is because if we are not familiar with them, especially the last, you know, since 9/11, what they've been doing since 9/11, I think this is a sign that we have a very big detachment between ourselves and what is going on in the society around us. Which is nice, you know, if you just want to worship on your own and get by on your own. That's nice. It's nice to have that detachment. But it really means that you are not even paying attention to what is going on around you. And that can be very dangerous. That can be very dangerous to the health of Islam, to the health of Muslims. That can be very dangerous to your children, the next generation. So we have to have an idea of what is going on. Who are these people? So as I said, I will give you their names and their main organizations. So as I said, we have Frank Gaffney from the Center for Security Policy, Daniel Pipes at the Middle East Forum, Robert Spencer at Jihad Watch, and Stephen Emerson of the Investigative Project on Terrorism is what they call. Now, what these organizations did after 9/11, as I said, especially on some of the more right-wing news outlets, They found an opportunity to speak. And they found an opportunity to go up against the Muslims who were defending Islam or defending Muslims as a whole. And this gave them a voice. This gave them a popularity. People kept going back to them. And they took advantage of this in many ways. Number one is that when, after 9/11, all of these organizations, I forgot also the other one, Society of Americans for National Existence, Society of Americans for National Existence, it's called SANE. So if you belong to that, you are insane. But anyway, what these organizations did, at the time of 9/11, these organizations actually had almost no ties to other organizations. In other words, they didn't have like their board members sitting on other people's committees and so forth. They were just kind of off by themselves. So what happened after 9/11, whether it was a push from them or whether it was because they had this voice and they had this popularity, they started branching out. So now these groups are intertwined with other groups, other even mainstream groups. Things like the you know, we have a lot of what are known as think tanks here in the United States. So now these groups are intertied with things like the Heritage Foundation, the Hudson Institute, even the Brookings Institute, which is really not a right-wing organization at all. So they have now they have ties to all of these groups. And this also gives them, access to some of the richest people and some of the most powerful people in the United States. Because the people who sit on these think tanks, the people who are there either by name or they're actually there, these are some of the most powerful people in the United States. Whether you're talking about people who were vice presidents of the United States or secretaries of state or ambassadors or whatever, these are the kind of people who are there in those organizations. And now they have a link. So now these Islamophobic groups have a direct link with all of these organizations. This gives them money, this gives them power, and this gives them that all-important thing that people talk about, which is known as access. Power, money, and access. And we will see, inshallah, if I... We'll see, inshallah, some of the ramifications of that, inshallah. So they're spreading out to other organizations, and the end result also is they are also making these other organizations more anti-Islamic as well. So for example, between 2001 and 2003, if you study, there's something like 300 civil society organizations in the United States. From 2001 to 2003, only 10 organizations were producing anti-Muslim messages between 2001 to 2003. From 2004 to 2006, that number expanded from 10 to 16. And then by 2008, the number was up to 40. And the number continues to increase. So first we start out with a small number, a few right-wing groups. And as I said, they had anti-Muslim messages. And now by being able to contact and get into other groups, you find that even some of the middle of the road, and this is the important point, you find that even some of the middle of the road institutions and think tanks are now producing anti-Muslim messages. That was something unheard of before 9/11. That was something unheard of before these groups begin to develop and get their strengths that they currently have now. And they have done it in very strange ways. By the way, when we speak about Islamophobia, right now in this lecture I'm speaking about essentially Islamophobia from the right wing. Right-wing Islamophobia. There's also left-wing Islamophobia as well. There's also people on the left, you know, like Sam Harris and people like that, who are also very much Islamophobes. But we leave them for another time and place. They don't have the influence also as these right-wing organizations. And one of the things that they've done, they're very good at using the media. So they are different. So we have, for example, like Fox News. Fox is known to be right-wing. It's not surprising that Fox News turns to these kind of people to give them a voice. But the reality is also CNN. CNN is much more middle of the line. Even RT, Russian television, goes to Daniel Pipes is interviewed on there and so forth. So now it doesn't matter where you are in the spectrum. They now actually go to these people as experts. And by the way, none of these people are experts on Islam. Daniel Pipes is probably the one that has the biggest, academic criteria, but the rest have nothing. And they've had the opening in the news media, and they've also been active in many other ways, again, because they found lots of money behind them. In 2008, they put out a couple of movies. One of these movies was called Obsession, and the other movie was called The Third Jihad. So let me ask if any of you have seen either of these two movies. Obsession. Don't worry, it's not a porn flick or anything. And The Third Jihad. None of you have seen it? None of you have seen either one? Okay. So Obsession, what they did with this movie, Obsession, to show you how much money and effort they're putting into it, in 2008, they paid to have the DVD of Obsession in every leading Sunday newspaper in the United States. Now, this was like 10 years ago. Maybe some of you don't even know what newspapers are anymore. That's a problem. But at that time, it was a big thing. So you have the New York Times distributed throughout the United States. You have the LA Times. You have the Washington Post. You have all of these major newspapers. And on Sundays, the major newspapers always have, you know, they have like the cartoons, they have big sections, travel, and all of these things. So on Sunday, they actually included this DVD, this hour and a half long movie called Obsession, which is about radical Muslims trying to take over the West, and also the other one called the Third Jihad. The Third Jihad is hosted, by the way, by a person who calls himself a devout Muslim. And that is one of their techniques. As I said, first of all, they have their own self-defined experts. How they became experts, nobody knows. But anyway, they have the people who claim to be experts, and I'll give you an example of some of the things that they've produced. And then they also have either they have people that they call ex-Muslims, people who have left Islam and speaking out about Islam, or they have Muslims who are, again, calling themselves devout Muslims who are speaking out against what you would call basically fundamentalist Islam. And when I say fundamentalist Islam, I basically mean the people who go to the mosque, the people who have beards, the women who wear hijab. That's basically what they mean by fundamentalist Islam. So these two movies, also in a class recently, I showed like the first 20 minutes of each one of these two movies. The quality is very high, it's very powerful. And I showed them to a group of Muslims, you know, similar to yourselves, who had never seen it before. And I asked them to consider themselves as an American who had never met a Muslim who doesn't really know much about Islam. And all of them agreed that if you see these movies, you will fear Muslims. You will absolutely fear Muslims without any doubt. You know, even though at the beginning of the movie, they both say, this film is about radical Islam. And not every Muslim is a radical. But by the end of the movie, you forget all. I mean, that's never mentioned again. Right? The rest is all just killing, killing, killing. We're going to destroy the Western civilization. And especially that movie, which was hosted by a devout Muslim, as they call himself. You know, he said he found this document. So, again, like you people, I will ask you this question as well. So this guy, part of this movie, a lot of this movie, is all about this document, this secret document that he found. And the secret document is a plan about how the Muslims are going to destroy the Western civilization from within. Right? And he shows pictures of it and everything. So here you are, typical Muslims, right, living in the West. Are any of you familiar with a document that is like, you know, like the Holy Grail, if you're familiar with that expression? It's like, you know, the Zionist protocols that we're going to take over the West. So he makes this big thing about this document that might have, you know, maybe somebody wrote it, who knows, it might all be fake from the beginning. But basically, again, just pounding home the fact that these radical Muslims, they have just one goal, and that is to bring down the West and kill all non-Muslims and so forth. So this was one of their techniques. They are active in media. They are active on the internet. They have all sorts of websites. They're active on Facebook. They're active on Twitter. And of course, you would expect all of those kind of things. But as I said, the two main things that they have that they rely on are fear and anger. And what's amazing to me, and I'm going to make this point again later, is that these people are very right-wing. To the point that even within, for example, the Republican Party, which is a right-wing party, right, they're very right of the right-wing. What can I say? So, for example, even when Bush was president, and Bush, of course, was a fundamentalist Christian, born-again Christian, conservative Republican. So one of the many things. So they spread. Basically, they're good at spreading things. They have nothing behind it, but they spread things. So one of the things that they spread during Bush's time They don't have to do this during Barack Obama's time because, you know, they can just say Barack Obama was a Muslim, right? In Bush's time, they said that the terrorists, the Muslim terrorists, have infiltrated the U.S. government. The terrorists have infiltrated the U.S. government. And they point, for example, to organizations like ISNA and CARE, you know, that they have the president's ear and so forth. They speak about certain individuals in the Bush administration like Grover Norquist and others who have some ties to Saudi Arabia and whatever. So if you have any ties with any Muslim, if you have any ties to any Arab, if there's any Arab in the administration, you know, regardless of whether he grew up here and how Islamic he was or whatever, they will point to these, and they will say it openly, you know, that this administration has opened their door to terrorists. They are providing sympathy for terrorists. This is what Frank Gaffney wrote. That this administration have people who have made no secret of their sympathy for terrorists, provided them financial support, or excused their murderous attacks. And these people have been repeatedly put in front of the company of the president. It got so bad between them that even Karl Rove finally had to write an editorial in the Wall Street Journal to refute some of these people. So they are not just, by the way, they are not just attacking us. They are, as I said, they are far right. They are attacking basically anyone who doesn't have their fascist, it's basically a fascist design on the world. So that's one of the things that they spread, that they are, that the Muslims have infiltrated the U.S. Government. And again, they pointed to that meeting that Bush had with some of the Arab leaders that I talked about earlier, shortly after 9/11. And the thing is, as I said, as outlandish as these claims are, they were not just on Fox News and so forth, but they actually made it into the mainstream media, made it into like CNN and New York Times and things like that, which are basically much more middle of the road, much more mainstream. Of course, one of their tactics also that they emphasize a lot is that the mainstream Muslims, part of their proof that the mainstream Muslims of the United States, that essentially all of them are radicals or terrorists, is that you do not see the Muslims coming out against terrorism. And this claim that they have, they are clever, but I would say that in this particular case, they are being helped by the media as well. So this is a very big claim that they make, right? They come out and they say it many times, and even on that movie, The Third Jihad, hosted by given by a devout Muslim, he speaks about the fact, you don't see other Muslims out here condemning terrorism. So this is an argument that they make, as I said, quite a bit. And I think before moving on from this, I think we have to see exactly what is the truth on this issue. On September 11th, before the end of the day on September 11th, different organizations, the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE, the Muslim Public Affairs Council, the American Muslim Alliance, the American Muslim Council, these are basically the main political organizations of Muslims in the United States. Before even the end of the day of 9/11, they came out with a press release saying that American Muslims utterly condemn what are apparently vicious and cowardly actions. So they came out with a press release. And shortly after that, other groups like ISNA also came out with a press release condemning the terrorism as a whole, and in particular those actions. In fact, between 2001 and 2003, between 2001 and 2003, 12 mainstream Muslim organizations produced 27 press releases condemning 9/11 and other extremist acts. Of these 27 press releases, so you have to, in the media, if you are in the news, if you work for a news corporation, you get press releases all the time. Right? But we're talking about shortly after 9/11, the Muslims are in the news, And these are organizations that are well known as representing and respected within the Muslim community. And they're putting out these press releases. Out of those 27 press releases produced by these organizations from 2001 to 2003, only two of them achieved any media influence. The rest were all ignored. And especially by the conservative outlets. They were just completely ignored. So the press releases are out there, but if no one is listening, and you know, if no one's bothering to listen, then you leave the door open for the Islamophobic groups to say, you see, these people never condemned terrorism. At the same time, as one author pointed out, at the same time the news just ignored those press releases from the Muslim organizations, yet at the same time, over and over, you know, they showed those pictures of the Palestinians supposedly celebrating 9/11. That, you know, they showed over and over again. But the press releases where the Muslims came out condemning those actions and so forth, that they did not cover at all, except for two of them. So through these tactics, as I said, of fear and anger and so forth, and very false arguments with respect to Islam, and even false arguments, as you can see, with respect to the Muslim organizations, they have been able to gain influence. And this is not a minor issue, because as I alluded to earlier, before 9/11, these different Muslim groups were able to establish some kind of presence, have at least some kind of respect, and being seen by being seen and respected by the government. After 9/11, mostly as a result of the pressure and the attacks of these groups. There's also some other things that took place. If we had more time, we would get into some other things as well. But much of it is due to the attacks of these particular groups and the efforts of these particular groups. You see, the government, the U.S. government, the Bush administration, for example, cut off ties with different Muslim organizations. And what you see, for example, in the past, since 2008, 2009, 2010, and so forth, every now and then there's been sessions held in Congress, or they have been like Homeland Security meetings and so forth, where they are discussing the question of Islam and terrorism, or Islam and radicalization, or Islam and the American Muslims. So this is the U.S. government, this is the congressmen, for example, people like, you know, Joseph Lieberman, people like Peter King, right, discussing what should be our attitude towards the Muslims in the United States. What do we know about them? What do they believe? What do they think? And so forth. So these kind of meetings being held by Congress and so forth, if they are going to be representing, or if they are going to be talking about what's happening among Muslims in the United States, don't you think some of the major Muslim organizations in the United States would be asked to come and to explain some things? As I said, before 9/11, on the day of 9/11, they were there to meet with Bush. But now you have to distance yourself. Remember, also keep in mind how politics work, keep in mind how the media works. If you're running for office, if you want to run for re-election, you have to be careful who you're seen with. Even the Obama administration, there was a picture being taken and there was a woman behind him wearing hijab, they asked her to move. They don't want to be pictured as a terrorist, basically. Not just pro-Muslim, pro-Islam, or whatever. Basically, they are going to be labeled as supporting terrorism. Their name is going to be dragged down and so forth. So you have these different meetings taking place in Congress to talk about radicalization of Muslims. One of them, we talk about homeland defense and what should be our stance towards Muslims and so forth. And at none of these was any of the mainstream Muslim organizations represented. Some of these Islamophobic groups were represented, like Stephen Emerson and so forth. Some of the some of the Islamic groups that were created after 9/11, like in that movie, The Third Jihad, the one who was the one presenting that, his organization, they are sometimes brought, but not of the main, well-known, mainstream Muslim organizations have been invited to any of these meetings in Congress. So you can imagine what kind of picture they're being given. First of all, obviously it's not going to be a fair and just picture. You bring the enemies of Islam and you sit down from and you say, oh, well, what do Muslims think and what should we do about them? They brought someone, his name is Majid Nawaz. Supposedly, he describes himself, and this is also one of their techniques. They have a number of Muslims on their side working for them. Somehow, for some reason, they're all pro-Israel as well. I don't know how that works out, but anyway. So they bring this guy who describes himself as a former terrorist. So he's a former Muslim terrorist. Maybe he's retired, I don't know. And so Joseph Lieberman asked him, very, very clearly, he asked him, do all violent Islamists begin by studying within non-violent organizations? Would you agree with that statement? So first of all, by the way, I don't know if I mentioned this, this ex-terrorist is from England. They brought him from England. He's not from the United States. Doesn't have any connection with the United States, and when he was when people looked into him afterwards, it doesn't look like he has any connection even with people in England as well. So Joseph Lieberman asked him this question: do you agree with the statement? All violent Islamists begin by studying within non-violent organizations. So this statement, by the way, obviously comes from, he's quoting the statement, and he says, do you agree with this statement? This statement comes from an Islamophobe. Right? So his source, Joseph Lieberman's source, is an Islamophobe. And now he's asking this ex-terrorist Muslim, do you agree with this statement? This guy knows nothing about Islam in America. He's not part of Islam in America. But listen to how dangerous is this question. Basically, what they're saying is that if any Muslim goes to a mosque, if any Muslim goes to ISNA or any mainstream organization, this could easily be setting them on the path to violent terrorism. That's basically what they're saying. So basically it means every organization, every mosque is suspect. Because it says all violent Islamists begin by studying within non-violent organizations. They start there. They get fed there. And they give whatever they teach them to make them into violent terrorists. His answer was, so the Joseph Lieberman asked him, do you agree with that? And his answer was 100%, absolutely. The purpose of these organizations in the West is to recruit, I guess I should do this with an English accent, but anyway. The purpose of these organizations in the West is to recruit. These organizations have been very successful in using the Western media and diplomatic hub. As for the establishment of Sharia law, the goal is to establish it within these countries with a view expanding them after them. So that's the, as I said, this idea, or this thing that is going on, where we are not being represented anymore, even though we had a fairly decent representation. They had, for example, 9 Senate hearings in between 2006 and 2008. Between 2006 and 2008, they had 9 Senate hearings. Not one single mainstream Muslim organization was invited to any one of them. So this obviously this doesn't bode well at all. And this is the environment that we are in right now. They are probably getting stronger rather than weaker. Although, I mean, I don't know. They keep saying stupid things that you would think they're going to get weaker. Of course, one of the things also is the fear of the spreading of the Sharia. Right? So you get all these anti-Sharia laws. It's very bizarre. First of all, from a legal point of view, what they're doing, and one of their main leaders is a lawyer as well. I don't know how he justifies some of the things that he does. But from a legal perspective and everything, what they're doing is very strange. But they started this movement, And as I said, particularly this group called Society of Americans for National Existence, again, SANE, it was founded in 2006 by David Yerushalmi. He's a Hasidic Jewish lawyer. He wants to make it, okay, part of his goal is he wants to make it a felony, punishable by 20 years in prison, to knowingly act in furtherance of or to support the Sharia. First of all, what does that mean? Does that mean, for example, sisters wearing hijab, that they are supporting the Sharia? You might have heard the other day, there was a Muslim sister, a fairly young girl in France. Right? To go to the public school, she has to take off her hijab. So she's going to the public school, she wears hijab, she's going to the public school. Before getting to the public school, she takes off her hijab, because that's the requirement there. And then she was thrown out of school and sent home because they said her skirt was too long. And her long skirt is a sign of religious affiliation. That's the extreme that these people can get to. But anyway, as I said, what does it mean to support the Sharia, or act in support of the Sharia, furtherance of the Sharia? As I said, he wants this to be a felony punishable by 20 years in prison. Now, you would wish, you would hope that, okay, nobody's going to use it. This sounds pretty insane, doesn't it? Please tell me that you think this sounds pretty insane. Okay. This sounds pretty insane. Now, you would think someone like this, who has this group called SANE, you would think someone like this is not really going to be listened to very much. But he and a couple of other groups, such as the Center for Security Policy and so forth, they started this movement, as I said. They started this anti-Sharia movement. And part of this anti-Sharia movement, they started to pass, or tried to pass laws. They started to pass laws, or tried to pass laws, in different states in the United States, because, you know, the laws in the United States are more state-based than anything else. So they tried to pass these laws in different states of the United States. They would ban the Sharia. They would ban the Sharia. And so between 2010 and 2012, this legislation was proposed in well over half of the states of the United States. Okay. Legislation was proposed, and legislation was passed, okay, in six states. Legislation was passed in six states. But here's the most fascinating part, and this is the important part to catch here. If you look at the legislation, if you look at the legislation at the different and these different states, and you run one researcher, what he did was he ran a plagiarism test on these bills that have been put forward in these different states. You will find that in some of these states, for example, in Mississippi, if you look at the law that was proposed in Mississippi, 82% of the text of that law comes from the SANE website and what they are asking for. 82% of the law comes from these Islamophobic organizations. In another state, so 82% I think was the highest. Minnesota, it was 73%. In the states that the law was passed, for example, Louisiana, 25% of the law came from the wording of these websites, of what law they want passed. So this shows you have these different laws proposed in like 30 states, and most of them, for the most part, a good amount of the law that was proposed comes directly from these websites. This shows you, as I said, it sounds like an insane idea that we have to ban the Sharia. If anyone works for the Sharia, he should go to prison. But you can see from this the amount of influence and the amount of actual power that they have. And not only that, what we saw in recent elections is that some people were actually running for office, and this was one of their key things. I am against the Sharia. I am against the Sharia. This is one of the key things That was basically their platform. And some of them actually won. They maybe had nothing else to offer except the fact that they are anti-Sharia, and they won in their representative places. Another very dangerous trend as well has to do with the training of counterterrorism agents. So again, before 9/11, different mainstream organizations had some interaction with the FBI and were able to communicate with them and so forth. After 9/11, a lot of these things fell apart. And instead, what we find is these different organizations begin to have a greater influence. I will give you just one example, and maybe it's the most obvious example. And that has to do with the New York Police Department counterterrorism unit. So we know, it's well known, I mean it's well documented in the news, that this counterterrorism unit in New York was basically watching Muslims. And they were watching Muslims even into New Jersey. It wasn't even just restricted to New York. Okay. So now the question is, these counterterrorism agents who are out there watching Muslims and trying to be careful about Muslims and so forth, what is the basis of their knowledge about Islam? So the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, through what is known as the Freedom of Information Act, in the summer of 2011, filed a petition to see what was being used. So there was in training these counterterrorism agents to study Muslims, right, and to be on the lookout for Muslims and dangerous Muslims, they found that they gave these agents, police and FBI, they gave them a PowerPoint presentation. This PowerPoint presentation that they gave them, okay, the slides in these PowerPoint presentations include 124 references to the main Islamophobic organizations that we've talked about. So the basis of their knowledge are things like the Middle Eastern Forum, the CSP, the SANE Investigative Project on Terrorism. Among the books that they distributed to them was Robert Spencer's book on the Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam. And also among the material that they distributed was this movie, this documentary that I talked about earlier called The Third Jihad. They distributed this to at least 1,489 officers during 2011. So this is all, as I said, this is all the result of how these people have come from the fringe, basically just wackos out there, to become part of the mainstream. That they can have this kind of influence over all of these different governmental organizations, this means they are mainstream. We cannot deny the fact that they are now mainstream. The fact that the number of people who are showing a dislike for Islam is more than 50% now, there's no question that now this belief, this idea, is part of the mainstream. If you actually look at these people and study them, even independently of Islam, the fascinating thing about them is that they are recognized as being fringe elements, except when it comes to speaking about Islam. When it comes to speaking about Islam, their ideas are welcome, but otherwise they are considered pretty much fringe elements. One of the books, for example, that one of the people, Stephen Emerson's name is on the front of the book, praising this book. It's called The Grand Jihad. So if you just listen to the title, maybe you can get an idea of how they think. Okay. The name is called The Grand Jihad. And the subtitle is, How Islam and the Left Sabotage America. So somehow there's this great conspiracy between Muslims and left-wing politicians and left-wing individuals in the United States to sabotage America. Pamela Geller, also one of their leading individuals, with Robert Spencer, also one of their leading individuals that I mentioned earlier. They wrote a book together called The Post-American Presidency, The Obama Administration's War on America. So they are, I mean, this is the president of the United States, right? You would expect right-wing people would have at least some respect for the office, if not the individual. Now, as I said, these people are so out there. If people would just open their eyes, if the masses would just open their eyes, they could understand that they are so far out there. And recently, just to give you, I mean, we could critique so many things that they say, but I just want to give you one example. And this example took place after this, after the attacks in Paris, the Charlie Hebdo incident. Stephen Emerson comes on Fox News, and another reporter comes on Fox News, and they start speaking about these no-go zones in Europe. In a period of 2 days, they mentioned this 50 times on Fox News. No-go zones, no-go zones. Somebody put it together and they're just no-go zones, no-go zones, no-go zones. Anyway. So for example, he says, Stephen Emerson said that Birmingham in England, Birmingham is a city in England, well-known city in England. He said Birmingham is 100% Muslim. Non-Muslims are not even allowed to enter into it. David Cameron, I mean, to show you how a prime minister of a country has to come out and say this man is a complete idiot. Right? That's what Stephen Emerson. That's what when Cameron heard what Stephen Emerson said about Birmingham, he said this man is a complete idiot. This man who is influencing the U.S. government, who is standing in front of Congress and giving depositions on Islam and Muslims in America. It's clear this man is a complete idiot. You have actually the head of a, and he's a right wing. By the way, David Cameron is a right wing, right? He's not some leftist. But of course, the United States is much more right wing than England. He comes out and he says this man is a complete idiot. In France, and Stephen Emerson, he said, I had an argument with the ambassador from France. Okay. He said in France they have 750 no-go zones. These are places where Muslims are ruling. The police can't go there. 750 no-go zones. And he said, I had an argument with the ambassador from France. I said, it's on your website that there's these no-go zones. So here he's making proclamations. By the way, it was very funny to listen to BBC interview him later, you know, and basically ask him, you know, where did you get this information now? And he's like, well, you know, I can't tell you my sources. What did has Fox News said anything to you? Well, somebody coming on that said, no, Fox News is not going to say anything to him because that's what this nonsense is what they want him to put out. A French TV program also went to these no-go zones and interviewed the people and said, you know, what do you think about this area? Oh, it's very nice, it's very, and so forth. There's no truth at all to these no-go zones. What these no-go zones that you find on the website, in French it's Z, the initials are ZUS, it stands for the areas targeted for urban renewal. It's not a no-go zone. Now, how could these people, okay, and Fox News, as I said, 2 days, nothing but no-go zone, no-go zone, Stephen Emerson and others, right, they're propagating this nonsense. How could anyone listen to them after this? That was a couple months ago. If you put on other stations nowadays, you'll still see these same kind of people being interviewed. So this is a very sad situation. It's a very problematic situation. And at the very least, by the way, we need to be aware of what is going on. We need to be aware of what these people are saying, how they're getting this influence, and what it might mean for us as a community here. What it may mean for our children, and so we just close ourselves off to it. As I said, this is not going to bode well for ourselves here, inshallah. So I think I left a few minutes for questions. Riyad has told me that I have just a few minutes left. So inshallah. What's the solution?
What do we need to do? I mean, we know all this.
You mean other than hijrah? So, I mean, obviously, there are, alhamdulillah, there are different organizations. So one, as I said, first of all, you have to become aware. Yeah, you have to be care, if you're going to be living here, at least become aware of what is going on with respect to Islam. Okay. At least. Because as I said, your children, these children, mashallah, they're going to be growing up here, they're going to be living here. What kind of an environment is it going to be for them? Is it going to be, you know, one where they aren't going to be able to practice Islam whatsoever? So number one, you have to be aware. And alhamdulillah, number two, we have different organizations, number of different organizations, inshallah, like CARE, for example, who are trying to work, trying to counter what they're doing. Again, they're very well funded, especially after 9/11. They have hooked up into some very good source of funding. I mean, they have millions and millions of dollars that they're playing with. So if we are asleep and don't even know what's going on, if we don't know what's going on, we're not going to do much effort to counter it. If we're not going to do much effort to counter it, we're not going to have, our organizations are not going to have much funds to counter it. And then, you know, so we have to be aware, we have to take steps, we have to support, inshallah, those who are actively trying to counter these people, inshallah. A question from sister. Yes.
Another question. Can I just add to that?
Uh-huh.
And I actually think, just to add to that, we should also vote. Because unless, if they know that our voices and that people are actually voting, then they will start to try to listen to us if we vote.
Okay, so the sister is saying that, you know, taking part in the elections and voting is also, if they know that Muslims as a bloc, for example, are voting and so forth, then they might listen as well. Yeah. Voting, I don't know how much. There's so much that goes on in the political process other than voting. That is so much more important than voting. That I'm a little bit worried that voting will have limited effect. But inshallah, it should have some. Hopefully, it'll have some positive effect, inshallah.
Yeah. Those conservatives, you know, since we are talking about voting, are they Republican or they are Democrats? You know,
so the people that I described today, as I said, you have right-wing Islamophobes and you have left-wing Islamophobes. So the right-wing Islamophobes are the ones that I described. The right-wing Islamophobes are much more powerful. The left-wing people like, you know, Sam Harris and so forth, they don't have much. Because, you know, left-wing are, by definition, left-wing are more open, right? So they're not going to condemn a people as easily as the right-wing. But the right-wing, especially the far-right, you know, these people are maybe just a little bit to the right of like Adolf Hitler or something like that. These people, you know, within like the Tea Party movement, for example, sometimes within the Republican Party, they also cause problems. Because they are such an extreme. So when it comes to other issues, as I said, no one's going to listen to them. But unfortunately, when it comes to speaking about Islam, even though these people are essentially, you know, very much a fringe, I'm trying to use a polite word here, they're very much a fringe element. When it comes to speaking about Islam, they have influence. When it comes to anything else, no one, for example, within the Republican Party is really going to listen that closely to them, except in very few circumstances. Yes, good.
Also, people are praying with what they don't understand. So if people don't understand Islam, they're going to be afraid of it.
So people do have a tendency to be afraid of things that they don't know, they don't understand. As we said at the beginning of the lecture, you know, the poll was shown that 2/3 of Americans have never met a Muslim and so forth. So if we can be, you know, if we can make da'wah, be more active as well, making da'wah, spreading, inshallah, the true message of Islam, inshallah, that will also help, inshallah.
But in terms of, a question for you. Do you envision the left?
Question for me?
Yeah.
Oh, inshallah.
Hopefully you have to answer. Do you envision that the right-wing side of America will unite with the left-wing and combine the effort? And the example I'm going to use is recently Bill Maher, when he attacked Muslims, the right wing kind of put him up in a pedestal and made him to be, look, even the left side, liberal people are even attacking Muslims. Do you see a marriage there between both in America and the future?
So when it comes to this point, the Islamophobes on the left and the Islamophobes on the right. Yes, the Islamophobes on the right are going to try to take advantage of the Islamophobes on the left. And as you said, from their perspective, it's a strong argument. Look, even these left-wing people, you know, are open to. But they have to be very careful, you know, because these left-wing, like Bill Maher and Sam Harris, they are also extreme atheists. And these Republicans, these far-right, are not atheists, right? So they have to be careful, you know, how much they're going to be lifting these people up, because if you're going to lift them up on Islam, what about on atheism? So I think they're going to be cautious. They're never going to be, you know, completely together. Yes, go ahead. Last question,
John. In terms of the response from the Muslim community in America and elsewhere, it looks like the responses are okay. What is their endgame? Where do they want to stop? And then the response, the appropriateness of response is, we present different groups of Muslims, they present themselves as differently, right? From the hijab, dress, and those type of things, then they, you know, associate more, look like more close the look like the American counterparts, whether it was non-Muslims. So that in terms of response, what is the appropriateness of response, and what has been so far response from the American Muslim community? Is it how is it helping or damaging, or what's your assessment, Sheikh Imam?
Well, if you go back to 9/11. And you'd look at groups like CARE, for example, and so forth. There might have been some tactical errors that they made, because they did, you know, they first tried to come out and not be emotional and just kind of lay down, look, this is what terrorism is and this is what's behind it, and don't tie it into religion, while the others are yelling and screaming at them and they're trying to speak calmly and so forth. After some time, and there was, by the way, there was a split within the Muslim response. Should the Muslims be defending Islam or condemning terrorism? So some of those groups, like the one, that individual that I referred to earlier, he's like, we should be all about condemning terrorism. So even the mainstream of the Muslims kind of split. But when the Muslims tried to come out on the offensive and have that emotional language and so forth, these Islamophobes were doing, it backfired a little bit for a number of reasons. And I think one of the main reasons is that even if it was an American Muslim, because I mean, CARE has some American Muslims, you know, like white American Muslims and so forth, but because Islam and Muslim is so foreign, they kind of see, who are they going to identify with? This guy who is a Christian and this, or this guy who is either a foreigner or he looks foreign or he's talking foreign stuff. So it kind of backfired as well. When they saw that they're using emotional language and anger and fear, and this is working in the media. So when they tried to respond with that as well, it didn't work. So it was almost like a lose-lose situation. So the response is going to be difficult, because, as I said at the beginning of the lecture, actually some of this feelings towards Islam go pretty deep. It's not, they are maybe now more willing to say it openly. You know, even these public opinion polls, there is this, I forget what the researchers, some kind of bias that the researchers mentioned, where even if it's an anonymous poll, you don't want to answer questions that you're going to show even to yourself that you're a racist. Right. Even if it's actually how you feel, like if someone asks you, do you like Muslims? Even if you feel like, no, I don't like Muslims, you're not going to say, no, I hate Muslims. You're going to say, well, they're okay or something. Even to yourself, you don't want to put. So there is this bias, as I said, researchers have a particular name for that kind of bias. So you can't put too much weight sometimes in there, but the fact that they're willing more and more to show their enmity towards Islam, this is a dangerous sign, as I say, of how much more and more this is being accepted. And I think we have a long way to go to undo some of the things that they have done. you know, as I said, if rational people would sit and listen to them and see how they come up with stuff which is just nonsense, you would think, you would hope that rational people would just say these people are, you know, whether they're speaking about Islam or other issues, they're just out there. But unfortunately, because of 9/11 and because of other things, as I said, we as Muslims give them a lot of ammunition. So people are willing to listen to them, even though it is the case that, that what they're saying doesn't really make much sense, unfortunately.